Our Father in heaven, we do thank you for the privilege of studying your word together and of rejoicing in the eternal truths that we find there. We thank you for how these truths have changed our lives and are changing them. And I pray that today, as we look into this wonderful book of Exodus, this crucial event in history, that you'll enable me as I teach and enable each of us as we learn together, that we may be empowered by your Holy Spirit to love your word, to learn your word, and to apply your word in our lives. We'll give you the praise for it. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Probably Exodus is one of the books that most people are more familiar with than others, especially the Moses and his call and beginnings and so on, the backgrounds of the book, and especially the whole Exodus event with the plagues and so on. I would like to, first of all, emphasize the significance of the book of Exodus in history and what God is working out. And so turn, please, to that first page in your notes on this, on the supplementary materials. And you'll notice at the bottom of the page, the Exodus, purposes for the Exodus event include the significance of these things. In other words, I'd like you to note those eight items to try to get a background fix on and appreciation for this whole book of Exodus. Once again, we have to be very sure that we see the book, the Bible book, in the stream of history, not isolated. It's not an island. There was a significance to Israel's residence in Egypt. I'm going to be speaking about that in just a moment. And then the events of the departure. This has to do with the with Moses challenging Pharaoh, the various interviews with Pharaoh, the nine plagues, and then the one judgment, and the Passover, and so on. And then, of course, the Mount Sinai experience, the significance of this. It was very significant in Israel's history because this is where they got their constitution. This is where they got the commandments. This is where they got their authority, so to speak. And then the journey itself, the journey out to Sinai, and of course the journey on after Sinai. The journey after Sinai isn't picked up in the record until the first chapters of Numbers. The route which is followed, the route through the Sinai Peninsula. And then the Kadesh Barnea experience. This was extremely important. They got out of Egypt and everything went on schedule until they got to Kadesh Barnea. Now, Kadesh Barnea is at the northeast corner, we might say, of the Sinai Peninsula. It's at the southern border of Palestine. And this is where God intended them to go in. And one of the great events, tragic events, of the whole Old Testament is the fact that they did not go in. And they wandered then for another 38 years, the 38 years of wandering. And then finally they come up and they cross the Jordan into the land. So these are eight important events that have to do with the whole Exodus sequence. Getting out of Egypt wasn't enough. Getting through Sinai wasn't enough. There are certain things that happened in there, some planned and some unplanned from human standpoint. And then getting them up ready to go into the across the Jordan River into the land. So often, even from the title of the book, we think of the Exodus as the Exodus. But it wasn't the Exodus to come out of something. It was the Exodus to go into something. And the land and the possession of the land becomes very, very important. So if you'll turn the page, you'll see that we pick up on that. Because the ultimate purpose behind the Exodus was not to deliver them from Egypt, but to implement the Abrahamic covenant in terms of possessing the land. At least the first phase of fulfilling the Abrahamic covenant. You realize that up until this point, they own no property. The descendants of Abraham own no property in Palestine. They had been out of Palestine for several hundreds of years. And the Abrahamic covenant looked like just so much talk. The Exodus records the basic steps in God's fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. Now you'll notice there are two sections under that. One is for Israel and one is for all people. In other words, there are immediate implications for Israel, the nation Israel, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But there are also implications for all people. First of all, for Israel, a nation was established. We have to remember that when Jacob went with his sons down into Egypt at Joseph's invitation. And by the way, it's just a miracle of how when they sold Joseph into slavery, they thought they were getting rid of a sort of a prissy brother that was embarrassing them and was putting them down. And instead, they started a sequence of events which turned all history. Because when Joseph went down there, he established a bridgehead by the grace of God with his relationships with Pharaoh and his expertise and so on and his new position. And then when he was down there, the brothers came down, the whole family moved down until in the land of Palestine, there were no descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they were all down in Egypt. But why were they down in Egypt? They weren't captured. They weren't kidnapped. They were down there because of a famine, but and because Joseph had gone on and made the bridgehead by this great miracle of God's leading and bringing about the sequence of events. But they're down there for a purpose. And often we think, well, somehow they got trapped down there. They had to make bricks. They were chained up at night. They couldn't get away. They're slaves. Nobody could escape. And they were hostages. Not at all. They were down there for a fantastic purpose. First of all, as a people, they were developed from one family into a nation. There were 70 when they went in, and there were 2.5 million when they came out. Well, God said to Abraham, I'm going to make of you a great nation. Where did he do it? He did it in the hothouse of Goshen down there. And it took several hundred years. You say, well, why couldn't he have done it up in Palestine? Because up in Palestine, they were nomads. They owned no land. And if they tried to own the land or possess the land, how could they do it? 70 people? Just march around throughout Palestine and say, hey, guys, we're going to take over this land. Parasites, get out, you know. And all the otherites get out. They couldn't. They were only 70 people. So they had to be developed into quantitatively a large people. In other words, they had to multiply. And that was a beautiful place to do it because for several hundreds of years, all the time they were down there, they had no military threat. They were protected. They were protected. There was no military threat. There were no hassles. I've got to keep going for it. There are no hassles down there at all. They're just really protected. And then as they were down there, they needed to develop a sense of nationhood. Now, they did not see themselves as a nation. They just saw themselves as a multiplied great number of descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's how they viewed themselves. You see, we talk about the nation Israel, but I'm trying to get us back into their sandals or bare feet or something or other back there, so that we can realize that they weren't a nation. They were just a bunch of people. They were just a big extended family was all. And God let this big extended family grow and grow and grow and grow until there are 2.5 million of them. And he did it down there in the growth chamber, if you please, the hothouse, the greenhouse of Goshen. Now they'd also, there became, as they came out rather, they began to have an identity. The people were unified by several things. Toward the end, there was oppression. Most of the time, they were not oppressed. Most of the time, they were just farmers with very fertile land. I always wondered why the Egyptians let them have the best land down there. But it was just beautiful, man. Cotton fields, you know, and leeks. And remember, they loved the leeks and the onions and the garlic. Maybe that's why the Egyptians didn't come around. I don't know. But then when the oppression came, there was a unification of them, just as happens in any situation when a people is oppressed as a people. And their experience together and their worship together, all of these things tended to give them an identity as a people. Their culture, this was unique. Their value systems, their culture, their relationship, their customs, their relationships. And then later on, as you see, their skills. They were skilled in agriculture. They went down there as a bunch of sheep herders. But by the time they'd been down there, they learned agriculture. Clemson Extension, down there in the Nile Delta. They learned agriculture. They learned construction. They didn't know how to build anything. They learned how to construct. They learned crafts, how to work with silver and gold and so on. So that when they came out and they're going to build a tabernacle and later go up in the land and do all kinds of things, they'd had a course. This was Mitzrayim Tech. And for all these years, they developed father to son and so on. They developed all these skills and so on. And then, of course, as they came out, they had no government. But under the leadership of Moses, they came to have this theocratic form of government with God ruling through Moses. And then, of course, as we've seen, constitution and law. So all of the ingredients for nationhood were added one by one from this experience. But the first thing you have to have for a nation is people. And they were basically down there to multiply and build up a large number of people. So the experience of living in Egypt and the Exodus accomplished the absolutely essential result of making the descendants of Jacob, 70 of them, into a nation of 250 million people, so that after they left Sinai, they were ready to march into the land and fulfill the Abrahamic covenant in the sense of marching in and possessing the land. Now, for all people, there are some important things to be learned. The facts of redemption were illustrated. For Israel, the big thing was a nation was established. For all people, the facts of redemption were illustrated concerning salvation. Egypt is a picture of slavery to sin, working, slavery to sin. Death as a result of sin, the death angel, substitutionary atonement, putting the blood over the doorpost, the necessity of faith and obedience, deliverance from sin, and revelation of truth. These were very, very important factors relating to salvation. But there were also important things that were taught for all people with reference to sanctification, as we're going to see in the book of Leviticus, actually Exodus and Leviticus, with the tabernacle and the offerings. Holiness of God, that He's holy. You just don't go in and speak to Him easily. The mount on which Mount Sinai was, there were thunderings and lightnings, and they were not allowed to touch the mountain or they'd die. The presence of God, that God is a holy God. He's not just a little carved stick or a tree or something. He is a real person and a holy God. There's one approach to God and the sequence of the tabernacle offerings and so on. Intercession, the priesthood, interceding with God. Maintenance of fellowship, clean life, and if they sinned, how they would get rid of that sin. Implications for daily living, a separated people, and a witnessing in the sense that the nation Israel was said to be a witness to the nations as to who God was and that He was a holy God and that He loved people, that He saved people, He could take away sins, and He could give them a well-regulated and meaningful life. So there are certain things which are symbolically taught, theological points in which we have visual aids through here. Now, if you look at the general outline of Exodus, we'll just walk through that for a moment. As you can see, I've filled in these first 13 chapters. I've mentioned before that this isn't particularly how I'd ask you to fill them in, but one reason I use this page, that part of a page, as an illustration in that those blocks, is that the bands there, the columns were so narrow that you really couldn't write much in them. So I thought, well, we'll just leave my big print in them, and then you can do your writings in 14, 15, 16, and so on. In chapter 1, we have the history and the problem cited, the general background of it all. And then from chapters 2 to 4, we have the preparation of Moses, the man who's going to bring them out. Of course, that makes sense. If we're going to have an exodus, if we're going to have a deliverance, we've got to have a deliverer. And the background of Moses in chapter 2 is called in chapter 3, and his response in chapter 4. Now, that's not exactly accurate, because the call and response actually run through the last part of chapter 3 and all of chapter 4, as you'll see. And then in chapter 5, he confronts Pharaoh, and in chapter 6, Moses is encouraged by God. The reason he's encouraged by God is because Pharaoh won't listen to him. And from 7 to 10, we have the plagues, and all of this, of course, is the contest with Pharaoh. And finally, in chapter 11, we have the judgment of the firstborn predicted, and you have chapter 12, the Passover, the judgment, the firstborn killed, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and so on. And finally, in chapter 13, redemption of the firstborn and the exodus, they're on their way. So you should be able to easily think your way through those chapters. And for the rest of the hour, that's what I propose to do. Much of this is familiar to you, I'm sure, but I'd like to just walk through it with you and especially see the implications for this fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant and how God is working through all of this. You have read by now the very fine description of the background in Leon Wood. I think that's very exciting, very helpful. And when you find out who Pharaoh's daughter was, who was she likely? Hatshepsut. All right. Okay. Happy for short. When you find out the kind of person she was in history, namely that she would have been Pharaoh if she'd been if she had not been a woman, because when her father died, when the Pharaoh died, there really was no one adequate to take over. Several of the children died, and she had this weak brother and so on, and he was there, but he wasn't doing much, and she took over. This explains a lot of how she had the power, the authority, to get away with what she did with in the Moses situation. It also explains why Moses couldn't have been the next Pharaoh of Egypt, because there was already one appointed, Thutmose III. But it also explains why Thutmose III would be a potentially very jealous, almost insecure person if, as Moses, rose to power, and why when Moses killed this Egyptian and it was known, why he had such great fear, because he knew that there was a tension there. And given that situation, you can imagine why there would be a tension there for Thutmose III. And then he drove him out. And then that Thutmose III died just shortly before Moses came back, which is exactly what God said. And then Amenhotep II was another man on the throne. So I hope you've read that very carefully, and it explains a whole lot of things, and I'm not going into that background. I'm assuming that you actually have it. The kings then that arose that knew not Joseph were probably the Hyksos. And the Hyksos were afraid of the Israelites, because the Hyksos themselves were very few in number. And they realized that their hold on Egypt was very tenuous. They had moved in about 1730 B.C. or so on, and they had moved in, they had taken control of Lower Egypt. They were building actually new capitals, and the Israelites were helping them to build these capitals involuntarily. And the rest of Egypt was just kind of passive. They didn't have any strong leader at the point. At that point, the Hyksos, a foreign group, had moved in, so-called shepherd kings, and taken control of Egypt, almost by default. But their hold was very tenuous. They were few in number, and they realized that if this group of Israelites, 2.5 million strong, one of the ancestors of them had been Joseph, who was very well thought of by the Egyptians, if that group ever formed a coalition with the Egyptians, and there was a natural affinity there already from Joseph's experience with them, that the Hyksos would be in big trouble. And so it was not the Egyptians that were afraid of the Israelites. It was the Hyksos. And they put the pressure on them, and they ordered the babies to be killed and so on. But in God's wonderful providence, it worked out that this is how Moses was saved and how Moses developed and so on. And then Moses was taken in and raised by the Egyptian leaders, actually Hatshepsut probably, as the Egyptians came to power and the Hyksos were moved on out. So this is the background of chapter 1. There were two attempts to kill him. I'm sure you've noticed two specific attempts. One in chapter 16, that when the babies were born, as they were born, they were to be killed. And that didn't work. That just didn't work. And they had to have an alternate plan. In verse 22, they didn't say, they went up beyond that, and they said, every son that is born you'll cast into the river. This, of course, shows that they were afraid of military might. They were afraid of military uprising. So they wanted to kill off all the boy babies. Which brings us to chapter 2, the very familiar story of how Moses himself was saved and was rescued. And then Moses grows, and in verse 11, it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out unto his brethren. As he was being trained, educated in the university and the courts of Egypt, I wonder how many times during that 40 years he especially as he came to maturity, that he realized that he was not an Egyptian. He was an Israelite. And here were 2.5 million of his people out there who were in not very good circumstances. I'm sure that he often thought to himself, at what point am I going to be able to help them? How can I help them? In what way can I help them? And finally, he takes matters into his own hands. He goes out unto his brethren. That's commendable. But you'll notice that throughout this passage, he doesn't consult God. It's he or his are the pronouns used. He went to his brethren and looked on their burdens. And he spied an Egyptian smiting in Hebrew at one of his brethren. One of those illustrations that in our lives, a very important event can be just around the corner. We can stumble over it without planning to. Things build up in our lives, which just a phone call or a letter or a chance of a conversation can just trigger something that will happen. In other words, the reservoir sort of builds up there. And the pressure had built up for years for him to do something for his brethren. He was concerned about them, and we have to certainly honor him for that. But he went out one day, and it just happened on that day that there was an Egyptian who was beating away on an Israelite, one of his brethren. And he knew he was a minority group, Moses did, so he looked each direction to see if anybody was looking. And then he went in, and he must have been a pretty strong guy because he knocked off this Egyptian and killed him just like that. What do you think he thought of himself? He was a real hero. He had done something right. And he had done something right. It was God's plan to knock off hundreds of Egyptians, but not one by one. It would have taken a long time. It wasn't the right time. It was the right idea, but it wasn't the right way that God wanted to do it. He was really taking things in his own hands. And here's a guy that wants to do the right thing, but he does it in the wrong time and the wrong way. It's a warning to us, isn't it? That even though we see something to do, we don't jump in there without God's okay on it, without his approval. And he looked this way and that way. When he saw there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. It's a good thing it's sand. You don't have to dig very hard in sand to dig a grave. In the clay, it would have been hard. But he digs down the sand, puts the body in, covers it up. Can't you just see him smooth it all out, you know? Gets a branch, rakes over it so nobody would know there's anything in there, and goes his way. Okay, Israelites one, Egyptians nothing. And he's down. And I'm sure that when he went out the next day, he thought to himself, well, I guess that I'm pretty high in the eyes of my countrymen. This is going to be really good, you know. Everybody's going to think pretty well of me in this. And he kind of gets to think pretty well of himself, I guess. And the next day, he saw two Hebrews striving together. They were fighting. And if ever a man was all for justice, ethnic justice and social justice and all kinds of justice, it was Moses. He didn't like to see anybody oppressed. He didn't want to see one of his people oppressed by an Egyptian. He didn't want to see one of his people oppressing another person. And he was a real fighter for justice. And he goes up there, and he's going to pull them apart. And then the awful words come. The one guy turns on him with a sneer. Hey, what you going to do? Kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? Be sure your sin will find you out. The sand had talked. Apparently he had seen it. And if one person knows it, everybody knows it. And if everybody knows it, it's going to come to Pharaoh's ear. And he doesn't wait very long. He says, who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Who gave you the right to do this? Now, of course, the man was in the wrong. But on the other hand, he was in the right a little bit too, because God hadn't really appointed him. He hadn't given authority to do that. Moses had really exceeded his authority. He did not have authority from God to do that. And 40 years later, when God said, I want you to go back and deliver my people, he said, what authority do I have to do it? He wasn't going to make the same mistake twice. But he went back the next time, he had full authority. In many situations, however, he didn't get much better cooperation. Moses says, surely this thing is known. Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh. He just takes off, and it goes for 700 miles. He didn't go through the Red Sea. I guess he must have gone around. The fact that Moses didn't need the Red Sea open miraculously tells us that they didn't need it open miraculously either to get from point A to point B. But God, as we will see, led them by way of the Red Sea so that a miracle could be done. There was lots of dry land. You didn't have to go by the Red Sea. And you didn't have to go by in the place where there's a mountain on each side. So Moses made it on dry land all the way down. He goes all the way down to the lower part of the Sinai Peninsula. And Midian is actually in the Sinai Peninsula and also across onto what we call Saudi Arabia now. But he gets down there. And there's a priest of Midian, had seven daughters and wondered when they're all going to get married. And they go out to draw waters from the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away. Life hasn't changed much. Can't you see these girls? Every day they go down to water the flock, and every time they get there, the boys are there, and they drive them away and say, "Get out of here, you girls. We're not going to wait around for you." Some gentlemen they were down there. And here's good old social justice again. Moses stood up and helped them. He'd never been down there before. He had a lot of nerve. Here are all these guys down there hassling these girls at the well. And he stands there. He said, "We're not going to have this. Hey, get away from here, you guys. Let them do it." He watered their flock. And they got home early that night. They didn't have to wait for the fellows, the boys, to water their flocks. They get home early. And, you know, you get home late, you get in trouble. You get home early, you get in trouble. And their father says, "What are you doing home so early?" Of course, what he probably thinks is that they haven't watered the flock. And this is an unkind cut. They didn't know any better. They said, "An Egyptian delivered us." Well, he looked like it. I guess he talked Egyptian. He'd been in Egypt for 40 years. He dressed like an Egyptian. And as far as they were concerned, he was an Egyptian. They didn't know who he was. They never knew who he was. But they said, "An Egyptian did this for us." And of course, a man with seven daughters obviously says, "Where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. Bring him home for dinner. Surely we can find one of the seven." That So Moses comes back. He doesn't have much of a chance. He gets back there, and he's content to dwell with a man, and he gave him Zipporah, his daughter, and they have a little baby, and they call it, they say, "Well, we're expecting a little stranger," and that's what happened. His name was Stranger, so they called him Stranger because he was down in that strange land. And the king of Egypt dies. Now, we've covered a lot of territory. Between verses 22 and 23, there's pretty close to 40 years. The children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage. I want you to notice four things, four responses of God in verses 24 to 25. God heard, God remembered, God looked, and God had respect unto them. God hasn't forgotten them. So all the time that Moses is out there with his child Gershom and his wife Zipporah and his father-in-law Jethro, his other name was Reuel, looking after the sheep, things weren't good back in Egypt. A lot of brick-making going on. But the Pharaoh dies. And now comes the time in history when the wheels are grinding slowly, but they're grinding on. And God hears, God remembers His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God never forgets this. I want you to notice that everything that happens in here ties into what He promised them in that Abrahamic covenant. That's the basis. That's the charter. And God looked upon the children of Israel. He could see them, and He had respect unto them. He cared for them. To have respect unto them means to favor them, like being concerned about their welfare. And Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock into the backside of the desert, came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. We know from the context that this is Mount Sinai. Talk about an interesting touch of history and geography coming together. He's keeping sheep in this desolate land down there around a mountain that is going to become one of the best known mountains in all of history. And all he's, as far as he's concerned right then, it's just a big blob on the horizon. He doesn't know it. And the angel of the Lord comes, appears in a flame of fire. The angel of the Lord, usually taken to be the pre-incarnate Christ, Jesus Christ Himself. In angelic form, the angel of the Lord. And here's the bush that doesn't burn. He's never seen that before. He's seen lots of burning bushes. He hasn't seen one, and not an awful lot of entertainment out there in the wilderness, you know. You get tired of looking at those sheep all the time. And here's a bush that doesn't burn. Well, he's going to turn aside and see why that bush doesn't burn. he probably watched it and watched it and watched it and kept on burning and never burned out. He's like, hey, what's going on here? So he goes over there. He turns aside. He says, I'll go aside and see what's going on. Verse 3. When the Lord saw, he got his attention with a burning bush. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush. Now, it's not likely that God's going to use a burning bush to get the attention of any one of us. That is a burning bush that doesn't burn out. But let's be watching for burning bushes. How is God getting our attention? And I don't think we should become too sensitive on this, but I think we ought to keep alert, keep our antennas up. Pray at the beginning of each day, Lord, if you've got a burning bush for me today, let me see it. And let me turn aside to see what you've got to say. It might be some unexpected bad news, or good news for that matter. But something that catches our attention. God can catch our attention in a million ways. And he'll custom it to us. You see, that was a shepherd out in the wilderness, and so the most natural thing was a burning bush. He's not likely to use it with us. But he'll use something that is very germane to our lifestyle, germane, and that fits in beautifully with the way we live today. And he says, Moses, Moses. He says, here am I. Where's the voice coming from? Here am I. He says, take your shoes off. Take your sandals off. The place wherein you're standing is holy ground. He looks down. Doesn't look holy to me. But he takes his sandals off, and by faith, he stands there. He doesn't know how holy that ground is. He doesn't know what's going to happen in that spot. And then he says, I'm the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Notice how many times that comes in. He says, I've looked down on the people. I know their sorrows. And he says, I'm going to, verse 8, here's my plan for your life. You know, God has a wonderful plan for your life. He didn't find it out until he's 80 years old. But here it is. God had a plan for his life all the way through, of course. But he said, I'm going to come down and I'm going to deliver them. And I'm going to deliver them out of Egypt and into a good land. Notice in verse 8, it's not just getting them out of Egypt, but his plan was to get them into the promised land. God's plan for us is not to just get us out of condemnation of sin, but to get us into an abundant life. And there's a parallel here. Verse 10, come now therefore, because I've seen their problems, because I've heard their cries, come on now, therefore, Moses, I'm going to send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. Now, that's his commission to him. Verse 10. Burning bush, voice of God, shoes off, bare feet on the sand, and he says, I'm going to, because of my promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I'm going to send you to Pharaoh, and you're going to lead them out. Talk about leading. If any one of us got that direct leading, you know, we wouldn't go around to Dr. Burchett and say, well, I'm not sure if the Lord's leading me. Could you help me? I mean, that's just as plain as you ever get it. Moses wasn't quite ready to take it. And he says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? That I should bring them out? Who am I? Why'd you choose me? Notice by this time, he is very humble. I'm sure that by the time he ran out to Midian and married this girl and started to follow his father-in-law's sheep around for 40 years, he'd just about given up on any significant role in history. I don't know what he thought he was going to be used for when he got his PhD from the University of Thebes. But for 40 years, he'd given up any dreams of the future. I doubt if he dreamed ever. Probably he wondered, am I ever going to go back to Egypt? Will I ever see any of my family? I wonder how Aaron's getting along. My big sister Miriam, you know. I wonder if I'll ever get to see them before I die. Maybe family concerns. Concern for his people, yes. But I don't think he ever dreamed of himself as being involved in it. There may be things that you'll be interested in, some unreached peoples or some churches that are closed and need to be opened or whatever, in a vague sort of way, and you may never consider yourself to be part of the solution. But in God's plan, you may be. And he may put his finger on you and say, you've been wondering about that? I've got a solution for it. You're the solution. I'm going to work. And this is what he does with it. Well, the answer to this is, I will be with you. I want you to notice his problems and the answers. There are five of them. He said, who am I? I will be with you. It really doesn't matter who you are as long as I'm with you, is what he's saying. Moses, you can give me all that humble line all you like. I'm just a shepherd. I just keep sheep. I haven't been back to Egypt for a long time. I've forgotten everything I learned at university and grad school. I'm really nobody. I haven't been involved in public speaking for a long time. I don't speak sheep language, and I've had a big audience, but nobody's heard me. I've just been around here. I'm a nobody. I've married a Midianite girl here. And the Lord, in effect, says, forget it, Moses. None of that is relevant whatsoever. The answer is, I'm with you. Does that say something to you and me? You know, I'm just from this, and I've had this, and I haven't had this, and I'm not very good at this. Forget it. The answer is, I'm with you. And he says, as a matter of fact, I'm going to give you a sign. When you get out and get this all done, you're going to serve me in this mountain. You're going to be back here someday. You're going to come back here with 2.5 million people behind you. Well, Moses got another one. He says, when I get there, he says, what shall I say to them? Moses said to God, behold, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me, and they shall say to me, what's his name? What will I say to them? If I say the God of my fathers, our fathers, has sent me, what will I say? What's his name? Now notice, when he's talking about the authority to go to Pharaoh, the answer is, I'm with you. When he's talking about the authority to go to his people, the answer is, I am. You follow the difference? The I am answer, I am Jehovah, wouldn't mean anything to Pharaoh, but it would to the people. So when he says, how am I going to face Pharaoh? Who am I to face Pharaoh? The answer is, I'm with you. When he says, well, what will I tell the people? Who will I tell the people sent me? He says, tell them I am sent you. I am has sent you. The only existent one. Self-existent one. God said moreover to Moses, thus shalt thou say to the children of Israel. You not only tell them that I am sent you, but here's what you're going to tell them. Here's your speech, Moses. I'm going to write your speech for you. Now this is what you tell them when you get back there. And the rest of the chapter is the speech he's going to make to them. He says, you tell them this. You just tell them that I've heard them and that I'm sympathetic with them. I've left them there for a purpose, but now the time has come that I'm going to take them out. And verse 19, that the king of Israel will not let them go, not by a mighty hand, but he says, I've got a stronger hand than he has, and I'm going to stretch out my hand. And I'm going to intervene, and I'm going to get them out, and they're going to come out with a whole lot of jewelry. Now that's what you tell them. Moses said, they'll never believe me. Chapter 4, third one. Moses said, they'll not believe me. They won't hearken to my voice. He now gets really scary. He says, they won't listen to me. All right? God says, I got an answer for that. We're going to do 3 fast miracles. You ready, Moses? Ready. What you got in your hand? A rod. Okay? He says, throw it in the ground. It becomes a serpent. Moses jumps. He's all right. He says, pick it up. Moses goes to pick up by the neck where you normally pick up snakes. And God says, don't pick them up by the neck. There's no miracle in that. Pick them up by the tail. By the tail? By the tail. Faith. Less than faith. Okay. Faith 101. Pick up the snake by the tail. Picks him up by the tail very carefully. Snake doesn't do a thing. Became a rod in his hand. Whew, feel more comfortable with a rod than a snake. So he's got a rod by the tail now. He holds this up there. He says, all right, put your hand in your cloak. Puts it in, pull it out. Ah, leprous. Put it in again. It's okay. Whew. Boy, he's getting the message by now. He's really dealing with the power. And then the other thing about the water and so on. Then in verse 10, Moses still got a problem. Well, he says, Lord, I've heard all that, but he says, I got a fourth problem now. He says, I'm not eloquent. I'm not much of a speaker. He said, neither hitherto nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant. I'm slow of speech. I'm of a slow tongue. I don't think fast. I just kind of stumble over my words. Now, we don't know whether he really was or whether he just thought he was or whether he wished he were, but... He says, Lord, you need an eloquent person for this. You need a charismatic spellbinder to go in there and talk to Pharaoh and talk to the people. But God doesn't need a charismatic spellbinder. He just needs somebody who really knows God and that he's really sincere and God will enable. And God's answer for this is, who makes mouths? Who makes ears? Who makes eyes? If I've made your mouth, I can fill it. He says, I'll put it in there. I can take care of it. You got a speech problem? I'll take care of your speech problem. And I will be with your mouth and teach you what to say. That's a comforting verse. You're going to use it probably before your lifetime is over. And finally, in verse 13, Moses has one more proposition. Well, I've heard all that, Lord. He says, but I just assume you got somebody else. And finally, the Lord gets angry with Moses. In verse 14, He says, all right. He says, we'll use Aaron for part of it. And so they come to a kind of a compromise that Aaron's going to be a spokesman as well as Moses. And he says, you'll be God to him and he'll be the spokesman of the people. In other words, it'll be a chain of command. I'll talk to you, Moses. You talk to Aaron and Aaron will talk to the people. So, all right, that's how they're going to do it. So they go back, they start back to Egypt. And the verse that was asked about here, when he takes his wife part way at least, he has to be circumcised. And the children have to be circumcised because this is part of the covenant. He's going back now to begin the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. And so they have to have this ceremony. And he hadn't done it with his sons. And it says God sought to kill Moses. What he's actually saying here is that we're not going to go any farther. This is a serious matter, and you're going to be judged with death if you don't do this. And so, as you know, Zipporah is involved in it, and they do it. And so the circumcision takes place in order that the whole procedure might go on. And then Moses goes back, and he meets Aaron. They fall on each other and kiss each other and tells them all of this. And they go, verse 29, they get back to the elders of Israel. Hello, Moses, where you been? A lot of people born since you were here, just the old men and so on. Around that Moses would know. And verse 31, the people believed when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel. Listen to it, Moses. It's the best you're going to hear for a long time. Verse 31, they believed and they bowed their heads in worship. Now, if we could only freeze that scene into history and keep it there, it'd be fine. If we could only sort of freeze our maybe real victories on prayer day or in some extra good experience we have at a conference or at a quiet time and just freeze it, it would be great. They believed the word of the Lord, they worshiped the Lord, they bowed before him, and there it was. But life goes on and events start to come in, and you'll notice that for all of their belief, for all of their worship, events changed their course. And in chapter 5, Moses and Aaron go in and they say to Pharaoh, the first confrontation, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let him go? He says, I don't know the Lord. Neither will I let Israel go. He's going to get a fast course in theology. And he's going to know the Lord before he goes down in the Red Sea. Drowning, I presume. And so they said, let us go 3 days into the journey into the wilderness. Some have thought that this was deception because God meant more than this. I'd suggest two possibilities for this, and they both really tie together. One is that he was testing Pharaoh, because if Pharaoh wouldn't let them do the little thing, he wouldn't let them do more. So Pharaoh is being tested with whether or not he'd let them go 3 days. There's another possibility, and that is that in that kind of culture, there was a lot of bargaining that would go on, and you'd normally start to bargain. So let us go 3 days. All right, you can go 3 days. Then he said, all right, let us go 7 days. Let us go 7 days. And he might have extended it on, let us go entirely. I'm not sure that that latter part would is a legitimate explanation. But certainly there's no deception here. He says, let us go 3 days. He's testing Pharaoh. And I think it's gracious of God in a way because he's asking Pharaoh to do something small. But Pharaoh fails at the little thing. God doesn't say, let these people go to Canaan. Wow, I could never do that, but I could let them go 3 days. So in effect, God is making it easy for Pharaoh to obey something. But he didn't even obey that. So you know the story. He said, get you to your burdens, verse 4. They have to make bricks without straw. This doesn't make the people happy. And they come back and they said, we were better off before you guys got here. Verse 22, Moses says, Lord, wherefore hast thou so evil entreated this people? Why is it that thou hast sent me? And he's going to say that for the next 40 years. Why have you sent me? Why have you treated the people so badly? They've reacted against me. I'm getting all the flack. In chapter 6, God's encouragement of Moses is a tremendous statement. There's a lot of prophecy in that. Because in chapter 6, now you'll see what I'll do to Pharaoh. So that all of this circumstance, all of this bad reaction, was to let God act in a miraculous way. Verse 2, God says, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob by the name of God Almighty, but by my name Jehovah was I not known to them. Now, Jehovah had been used before, but Jehovah means the delivering God in this context, as we'll see. Jehovah was only a name. It was only a word, a name for God to them. But ever after this, the name Jehovah is going to be associated with the one who delivered them from Egypt. Jehovah, the Lord. Pharaoh said, I know not the Lord. And as a matter of fact, the Israelites didn't know the Lord really either. But they are going to know the Lord, and the Egyptians are going to know the Lord in a very special way. And I will pick up on that tomorrow. We'll just spend a few minutes through to chapters 11 and 12, and then move right on through their wilderness journey. Our Father in heaven, we come now again to the study of your word with a deep sense of awe for you and for it and for the way that you worked in history, especially in the history of Israel as you began to frame them and form them as a nation to be a testimony unto yourself. Again, Lord, we come to you and ask that you will explain this to us. Help us to remember the key things, that the key events that take place. Help us to understand the people. Help us to get in their sandals and think with them and react with them and appreciate and love you the more for it. For we pray in Jesus' name, amen. There are two or three issues in the that relate to the book of Exodus that I'm not dealing with in class, but I would mention that Archer has some good notes on this. The three of them are how long they stayed in Egypt. There is a debate, a discussion as to how long Israel was in Egypt, and the question arises from what Stephen said about it in Acts chapter 7, and also a verse here in our reading today that says there were 430 years. And relating that to the various generations and so on. But I draw your attention to Archer's note on that. Also, the date of the Exodus. There are two dates given for the Exodus, one in the 1200s and one in 1440. And we're taking the earlier date of 1440. Archer has an excellent discussion on this because he takes up the points given in defense of the later date, that is in the 1200s, he gives a good discussion of those. He handles them seriously. He doesn't just dismiss them, but then he shows the evidence on the other side, and he comes up with what is usually taken in conservative circles as the standard date of 1440 for the Exodus, and the 40 years in the wilderness brings them down ready to go in the land about 1400 or 1401. So in case you're wondering about that, I would draw your attention to these. All right, picking up where we were yesterday in Exodus chapter 6. We have found that God has now prepared Moses. He's 80 years old. 40 years he spent in Egypt getting prepared. 40 years in the wilderness with more preparation. And he's going to have a 40-year period of ministry. So he's going to die at the age of 120 years just before they enter the land. He will never himself personally get to set foot on the land. In chapter 5, he and Aaron come to make their proposition to Pharaoh, and they said, in effect, let my people go. We're going out and worship the Lord. The Lord has sent us. And Pharaoh says, who is the Lord? I don't know the Lord. Get back to work. You shouldn't be thinking this kind of thing. You've got too much time idle. I'm going to make it harder for you to make bricks. I'm not going to give you the straw to make them with. There's a long story about the chemistry of the straw and how that works in. And that, of course, turns the people against Moses and Aaron for the first, but by no means the last time. And now the people are turned, and they blame Moses for everything that happens. And remember that Moses stands as the mediator between God and them. So we can just put it down in our minds and hearts that every time they complain against Moses, they're complaining against God. As a matter of fact, God says this in several places. They're not after you, they're after me. And one of the big lessons I want us to learn as we go through these chapters in Exodus and in Numbers is that when we have adversity, when everything doesn't work out as we want it to, when all the resources that we would like to have are not right there, the worst thing we can do is to say it's God's fault and start to lay blame. The best thing we can do is to say, thank you, Lord. This is going to be a great opportunity for me to see what you're like and get a theology lesson. And really, that may seem simplistic, but that is what the whole story's about. That's what the whole thing's about. And for 40 years, that generation wasted time. They were never happy. They were always mumbling and murmuring. They were grousing about everything under the sun. They never learned to cope with the issues or the challenges around them. And whereas they could have been living to a ripe old age drinking, eating honey and drinking milk, and presumably a bit of steak along with it, in a land flowing with milk and honey, they could have retired there. Instead, they got buried under the sands of the Sinai Peninsula, simply because they couldn't cope with the issues of life around them. It's a marvelous visual aid of this whole thing, and I want us to keep that in mind as we go along. Well, it begins in chapter 5. And of course, this is Moses' first encounter with disbelief or opposition on the part of his own people. But the Lord comes through in chapter 6 and gives him this tremendous encouragement. Then the Lord said unto Moses, "Now, in this circumstance, now shall you see what I will do to Pharaoh. With a strong hand, he'll let them go." In other words, you're not going to sneak out at night. But I'm going to arrange things so that not only will he let you go, he's going to throw you up. He's going to be glad to get rid of you. You're going to take a whole lot of wealth out with you. And the cause of all of this, the basis of it, is in verse 2, "I am the Lord." Because I'm the same Lord that appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You haven't known me by the name Jehovah. That name hasn't registered with you, but I am Jehovah, the delivering God. And I have established my covenant with them, that is, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage. They didn't own property there, but you are going to. And I'm not just taking you out of Egypt so you don't have to make bricks in your old age. I'm taking you out of Egypt so you can go in and live with the milk and the honey. And I remembered my covenant, verse 5. Notice how important that covenant is. Verse 6, because of the first 5 verses, because of who God is, because he's going to keep his covenant, wherefore, say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord. You tell them that. You go tell them. And I'll tell them that I'm going to bring them out from the burdens of the Egyptians, and I'll redeem you with a stretched out arm. I will take you for a people. This is kind of a landmark document here. This is the charter of the whole thing. This is an important passage. I will take you for a people. I will be your God. You will know that I am the Lord your God. I will bring you into the land, and I will give it to you for a heritage, for I am the Lord. So in verses 6 to 8, he gets the mandate, he gets the message that he is to tell these people. That's what's going to happen. And there's no equivocation about it. No ifs, ands, or buts. Not if we can, you know, if we can balance the budget and it doesn't rain on Tuesday or something. It's just straightforward, laid out. When God's going to take action, he knows where he's going and he can follow it through. And Moses says, listen, Moses spake unto the children of Israel, but they hearkened not unto Moses for the anguish of spirit and for a cruel bondage. They wouldn't listen to what Moses said about God because they were too concerned with their anguish. They were too concerned with their pains. They couldn't believe. They wouldn't believe. The Lord says, all right, now you go talk to Pharaoh. Now, if you're Moses, what would you think? You think, wow, I didn't get very far with the Israelites. I'm going back into the meat grinder if I go back and talk to Pharaoh. And he says that in verse 12. He says, behold, the children of Israel, they won't listen to me. Then how come Pharaoh's going to listen to me? Okay, now we break off at that point until we get down to verse 30. And everything that comes between there and verse 30 is sort of a parenthesis, because we pick up the action again in verse 30. So verse 30 says just what verse 12 had said. Moses said before the Lord, behold, I am of uncircumcised lip. How shall Pharaoh hearken to me? In chapter 7, I have made thee a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron thy brother shall be the prophet. Now that, of course, doesn't mean that Moses is God, but he's speaking as God, so that when Pharaoh deals with Moses, he deals with God. And he says, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. Verse 4, don't be surprised, Pharaoh will not hearken to you, that I may lay my hand upon Egypt. And in verse 5, the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. Now, you're going to find that phrase several times, and it all goes back to chapter 5, verse 2, where Pharaoh says, who is the Lord? I don't know him. He says, all right, you don't know him. You ask, you'll find out. You're going to get an answer. And verse 9, when Pharaoh shall speak unto you, saying, show a miracle, he says, all right, you take your rod, cast it before Pharaoh, and it's going to become a serpent. Does that ring any bells? He'd already practiced them on that. He drilled them on that one. And so as we come into chapter 7, verse 10, we find the first contest with Pharaoh. And he comes in, and we find that his people, his magicians, his sorcerers can imitate this, but if you read carefully, you'll find that they can only imitate so far. And we come into the first plague. So in verse 20, we have the first plague, and this is when the waters turn to blood. Now, you might just want to check in your notes on that, some notes on the plagues, so you can read them for yourselves, but in pages 2 and 3, I just draw your attention to them. There are five ways in which the plagues were demonstrated to be supernatural. Many commentaries that you read will have all kinds of wonderful explanations for how these things happen naturally. Just amazing. But there are five aspects of them which certainly give evidence that these were not natural phenomena. Intensification. Yes, they were natural events. They'd had flies before. They'd had cattle disease before. They'd had hail before. But the intensification of this, of these natural events, was unique in its severity and its timing. And so the intensification of them, they'd never had it that bad before. They were record problems with the frogs. They'd had frogs, but they never had frogs like that. They had flies, but they never had that many flies. And also the timing of it. They might happen once every 20, 50 years, something like that, but to have them happen all in 6 months and have them happen exactly when Moses said they're going to happen, I mean, that's supernatural. And then the prediction, this is really the second point. The time was set for the coming and removal of three of them. He said when the flies were coming, when they're going to go away, and the marine, this is the cattle disease, and the hail. There was discrimination. In the case of three of these, they did not take place in Goshen. And it would be hard to account for why the flies would suddenly stop at the border of Goshen where the Israelites lived, unless there was something supernatural. The sequence. You'll notice there is a progression. The first three or four or five aren't all that bad. They could survive with those. It'd be rough, but they could survive. But they become progressively more devastating. And then uniqueness. The tenth one was obviously divine intervention. There is no natural phenomenon that could be related to all the firstborn of the animals and of the people being killed in one night at midnight, and then all of the firstborn of another people that lived just a few miles away not being touched. And so these are some evidences, as you may read some counter opinions. And then the relation of the plagues to the gods of Egypt, you don't have to know this for an exam or anything, but I thought you might just like to have the record of it. That in every case, one of these plagues, in every case, was a direct, I guess in the colloquial language we'd say, a direct shot at each of the deities of Egypt. It made fun of them almost. They worshipped the Nile River. It was a sacred, the Nilus, the sacred river god. So what happens when it all turns to blood and smells and they can't use it? They worship frogs. It's nice to worship one frog on your desk or on your mantle. But when you're stepping all over your gods, it gets a bit untheological and messy. The purpose of the plague, section E, there are four basic purposes. To punish Israel for enslaving, punish Egypt, rather, for enslaving Israel. Obviously, to facilitate their deliverance from Egypt. To show that Israel belonged to Jehovah. That comes through especially in the discrimination ones where the Israelites weren't hit. And of course, to demonstrate Jehovah's supremacy over the gods of Egypt. When they got through, I'm sure that they were, when all these finished, I'm sure the Egyptians were pretty devastated in their worship. It's pretty hard to go back, you know, the next Saturday morning or Tuesday afternoon or whenever they used to offer the sacrifice to the frogs again. The image, if I may put it that way, with double meaning, the image of these gods certainly lost something during the 6 month period. And it may well be, that that's why some of the Egyptians apparently went out, because it says later it was a mixed multitude. Now, the mixed multitude, by the way, may refer to the fact that some Israelites were not true believers, even though they're rescued. And it may also refer to the fact that some Egyptians went with them. We really don't know. We'll get to section F a little bit later on. It's very important. All right, the first one then is the blood. In chapter 8, at verse 6, we have the second one, the frogs. 6 to 15. I'm not taking any time on these. I just want to point them out. And then beginning at verse 6 to 15, and then beginning at verse 16 of chapter 6, we have the third one, the lice. That must have been a very interesting one. Notice verse 19. Then the magician said unto Pharaoh, while they were scratching, "This is the finger of God." I like that, coming from the Egyptian sorcerers. They'd had enough of this lice business. They said, "This is the finger of God." They had real theological insight on that one. That goes through, of course, to 23, and then on come the flies in verse 24. Flies, flies, flies. And we notice that there are three attempts by Pharaoh to compromise. You'll notice how these increase. He's bargaining with them a bit. The first of these comes in verse 25. Pharaoh called for Moses and for Aaron and said, "Go ye and sacrifice to your God in your land." Okay, you've made your point. Fair enough, you want to worship your God, you want to be free. Well, I won't let you go free, but I'll tell you what, you can go sacrifice in your land of Goshen. Big deal. That was a compromise. That was just a little move, you know, a little friendly move to kind of get this thing off their backs. But that didn't work. And then in verse 28, we get the second one. He says, "I will let you go, and you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness, only ye shall not go very far away. Entreat for me." Pray for me. He says, "I'll let you go worship your God, and you go all the ways in the wilderness, but don't go very far away. I want you to come back. I want you to stay nearby." See the compromise? You let him go a little bit. He's kind of bargaining, which is, you know, a good practice in that culture. And then in chapter 9, we pick up the fifth one, which is the cattle disease. And of course, in each of these, Moses has come in and said, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh says, "Nothing doing, no way." And then down in verse 8, we pick up the boils. That's the sixth one, the boils. Getting worse all the time. Getting more personal all the time. Bad enough when the water in the Nile River turns to blood. But when you got boils on your body, that gets a little bit closer to home. And then in verse 22 of that chapter, we pick up the thunder and hail. That must have been some scene in verse 23. Moses stretched forth his rod toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail. It's kind of something of what John the Apostle wanted to do. You remember with the Samaritans. He said, "I'll call down fire from heaven." Maybe he had that in mind. I don't know. And then over into chapter 10, verse 8, we find the third compromise proposed. Chapter 10, verse 8, the third compromise. "And Moses and Aaron were brought again unto Pharaoh, and he said unto them, Go serve the Lord your God. But who are they that shall go? And Moses said, We will go with our young and all of them. And he said, Well, he says, I'll let you go, he says, but not your little ones. Your little ones. Want to keep them." And so this was a compromise that didn't work out. Verse 12 of chapter 10, the locusts. Beginning at verse 21, the darkness. So by the time we come to the end of chapter 10, that is from chapters 7 to 10, we've had 9 plagues. So if you're just kind of thinking your way through the book, the 9 plagues are in chapters 7 to 10. But in chapter 11, we come to a qualitatively different situation. This is not a plague. We say loosely there were 10 plagues, and that's all right. But there are really 9 plagues in the sense of 9 very obnoxious conditions that arose, the lice and the boils and the flies and so on. But none of those was really fatal. I guess if you got hit with a hailstone, it might be. But none of those was really fatal like this firstborn. This was a qualitatively different one. This is called a judgment upon the firstborn. And the Lord said to Moses, "Yet will I bring one plague more unto Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards, he will let you go hence." So, you see, God wasn't just saying, "Well, we'll hit him again and see what happens. We'll hit him again and see what happens." And I might have 20 or 30 or 40 of these things. God knew how many. He said, this is the last one. One more, and you're going to go. So you see, God, this shows that God had perfect control over this whole thing all the way. And he will thrust you out hence together. The King James in the next verse has borrow, and they didn't borrow, they asked them. Some have thought that this was dishonest, they never paid them back, but the Hebrew word simply says ask. Let every man ask of his neighbor, and every woman of her neighbor, jewels and silver and jewels of gold. Why on earth would the Egyptians give up their treasures to these people? They said, hey, give me your gold, give me your silver, please give me your silver. I suppose they said please. And the Egyptians just handed it over to them. Why? Well, by this time, I think they looked at them as some kind of a curse, and they just wanted to see them go, you know, take it and go. Why did God have them ask this? Was this fair to the Egyptians? Well, there are two basic reasons for it. Number one, they had earned it. They had earned it. They'd made enough bricks to get a whole bunch of gold watch bands and so on, you know. So they had earned it. They'd worked for it. The second thing is that that's where the materials for the tabernacle were to come from. So it was all Egyptian gold and silver that they used in the tabernacle. So God had this all planned. Of course, these people didn't know that at the time. And then he says in verse 3, and the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt and in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. That's kind of interesting. That whereas later, before this and after this, Moses was looked down upon by his own people. Do you realize that the Israelites never thought that at that time never thought that Moses was a great man? He rated a 1 on a scale of 10. He got a D minus or an F as a leader as far as the evaluation of that generation of people is concerned. There are only two or three occasions in which they thought he was great. Once when he came back and says, I'm going to take you out of Egypt, they said, that's fine, that's great. But as soon as things started to happen, they said, you know, what are you doing here? You're messing things up. It's worse than it was before. And the other time that they were happy with him was when they got to Mount Sinai and they said, we want a law. He said, will you obey the law? They said, oh, yes, we'll obey the law, we'll obey the law, we'll obey the law. There might have been two or three others, but those are the main two times that they're sort of happy. Once when they started the whole thing in Egypt before they'd even approached Pharaoh. And then once when they got to Mount Sinai. And virtually every other opinion expressed by these people about Moses was that he was a problem. If it only weren't for Moses, we'd be okay. Now, some people are problems. Some people in leadership positions are problems. But let's always be sure that the problem is with that person and not with us before we criticize that person. It may well be with us. And he was speaking for God. But, as I started to say, the irony of the thing is that Pharaoh's servants, which would probably include the army and the administrators, some of whom would have remembered Moses as he was growing up. In fact, some of these, if they're really old, might have been some of Moses' old professors or teachers. But anyway, the people of Egypt thought he was great. They thought, wow, look at the power. He's got more power than all of our gods. And although there isn't too much said about it, I get the impression that by the time these people left and all these plagues were finished, that they had a much higher opinion of Jehovah than they'd ever had before, and a much lower opinion of all their gods. They really did get to know that there was another God. And you see, they were tuned into power. The man that had the power had the big God. And they'd never heard in their history of such power as Moses exercised. So he was very big in their eyes. Very interesting. And he tells what's going to happen. He says, about midnight, I'm going to go out in the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt will die. Verse 6, there'll be a great cry throughout the land of Egypt, screaming in every house, such as there's been none like it, nor shall ever be again. I like that next sentence. But against any of the children of Israel shall not a dog move his tongue. You keep dogs quiet at night, you've really got a name. Some of you have problems with dogs. We do, too, in the neighborhood. That you may know how the Lord shall put a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. In the land of Goshen, it's going to be quiet. Not even the dogs are going to whine or bark. It's going to be perfectly peaceful and still. Nobody's going to die because they've got the blood over the doorposts. But there's going to be a difference. In Egypt proper and the rest of Egypt, there's not going to be a house in which there isn't a scream. somebody is going to find the firstborn dead. And as far as this message spread out, I'm not sure everybody heard the message, but as far as the message got spread out and they knew this was going to happen on that night, can you imagine how many people went to sleep at 9 o'clock and forgot about it? Can you imagine how the firstborn sons felt? They just had a series of 9 plagues. They knew something big was happening. This thing had been going on for about 6 or 7 months. And now the word was, the latest was, and you can imagine how sensitive they were and excited and scared, frightened, panic-stricken on what's going to be next. What's going to hit us next? Did you hear? Firstborn son's going to die. Firstborn son. And you know what a firstborn son would mean in that context. He would be the heir. He would be the next in line. He would be the son that would have all of the prerogatives and all the priorities. And maybe this firstborn son stayed up. Maybe the mother stayed up with their sons that night. But it was a heavy night in all of Egypt. And God was showing that there was a difference. Well, chapter 12, before this happens, we have to have the description of how they are to be preserved from it. This is to the judgment in Egypt what the ark was to the judgment over the whole world in Genesis 6 to 9. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, he says, "This shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you." And so ever after this, this has been the beginning of the Jewish calendar. And it begins with the month of what we would call March. I put it March/April because it depends on when the full moon comes and so on and how it hits our particular Western calendar. But it's going to be, but on the 10th of that month, you're to take the lamb and you're to keep that lamb for 4 days to examine that lamb to see that it's pure and clean and has no fault of any kind. Then on the 14th, you're to kill the lamb. And so Passover was on the 14th day of the first month. And this was, as he says, a beginning of month. You're going to start a whole new year. In effect, I'm starting a new nation. I'm going to start a new nation with a new year. And this is the beginning of the religious year for Israel. All right, 7 things are said. Verse 2, the beginning of months. Number 2, in verse 3, it says, "In the 10th day of the month you shall take to them every man a lamb according to the house of their fathers." So there's a lamb for a house. Now this doesn't mean a lamb for every dwelling place, perhaps, but at least for every extended family. And they all kind of lived together. They didn't have, you know, just a couple and 2 kids living in one house, but a lot of them lived together. And so 2 things then. It's the beginning of months, the 10th of the month are to take a lamb. The next thing is in verse 5, it's to be without blemish. Actually, there's a series of 7 things that they do here. We might as well start the number from verse 5 because it's a series of things they actually do to the lamb. In verse 5, it's first, without blemish. Secondly, a male of the first year. And third, you shall take it out from the sheep or from the goats. In other words, it's to be taken out, it's to be separated from them. Then you're going to, 4, you're going to keep it till the 14th day. And then 5, the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening, representatively. And 7, you'll take the blood and put it on the doorposts. And 6, in verse 7, you'll take the blood and put it in the doorposts on each side and across the top. And verse 8 is item 7, you'll eat the flesh that night, roast in the fire, and don't take any of it with you. You get down to verses 9, 10, 11. You'll see that they're not to leave any over. They're to try to eat it all. But if they can't eat it all, they are not to take it with them. And to me, this is amazing because flesh which has been roasted like that, you could, in a dry climate, you could keep it for a day or two and make good sandwiches along the way, if you like unleavened bread sandwiches. They said, roast it. Leave it all here. And then later on, he's going to talk about the feast of, the practice of the unleavened bread. It becomes the feast of unleavened bread. And once again, in the feast of unleavened bread, they are not to have any leaven in the bread they take out. Now, these two, I think, go together. And the basic concept is a separation from dependency on Egypt. A separation from dependency on Egypt. They are not to take any of the meat from Egypt with them. And they're not to take any of the leaven from Egypt with them. Now, the way they made bread, and of course the way we make bread today, is very conducive to teaching this. Because they would have a little bit of yeast in a lot of dough, and the woman would mix it all up and knead it and get it ready for the oven. But before she put it in the oven, she'd take out a pinch of it, a little bit of it, and put it one side in a cool place. And then she'd go ahead and bake that bread, and that's the day's bread. And it would just go up and rise, and there you got Pepperidge Farms. And there it is. But she's got this little blob of it over in the shelf. So what'd she do with that? Next day she puts that in the dough, or 2 days later, and that becomes the start for the next day. Quite a good picture of continuity, isn't there? But you see, if you don't have any leaven, you've broken the continuity. And I think the emphasis here is on breaking the continuity with Egypt. Breaking the continuity with Egypt. And so they come out with no meat from Egypt. They had this big Passover meal, but no leftovers. No leftovers. They were to burn the leftovers. And they were to have no leaven in the bread. None in their house even. And then, of course, this beautiful section in verses 12 and 13, I will pass through the land of Egypt this night and will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. Verse 13, the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are. A token of what? A token of obedience. A token of obedience. These people, when they put the blood up there, were saying in effect, we believe that death is coming. We believe that we are in danger, in jeopardy. We believe this. We believe that you've spoken, God. We believe you're coming. We are accepting your way, your provision for safety. We've killed the lamb like you said. We've taken the blood like you said. We've put the blood over the doorpost. We have obeyed you. And so, in effect, they had taken God's way of salvation. Now, of course, as I mentioned the other day, the blood itself was not what saved them, but the blood was a token that the animal had died. And the fact that the animal had died had spoken the truth that the wages of sin is death, that an animal substitute had died for them. But that animal was not a substitute for their sins. It was simply a substitute, if you please, or a token or a preview of Jesus Christ, who is to be the Lamb of God that taketh away the sin of the world. These lambs didn't take away sins. But they were pictures. They were visual aids to teach the theological concept. They were visual aids to teach the theological concept that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin, which simply says, without the death penalty being paid, there is no taking away of sins. And of course, another word for this, used for this is type. They were a type. And then, of course, when it's fulfilled in Christ, he is called the antitype, or the fulfillment of the type. And he then goes on and talks about this Feast of Unleavened Bread, which I've just been mentioning. And notice how this is to be a teaching tool in verse 26. Verse 26, when your children shall say unto you, what mean ye by this service? Then you shall say. Now, this question and answer actually is related to three different events. Now, let me say two different events because two of them go together. The Feast of Passover and Unleavened Bread start at the same time, and they are really grouped together for this. And even today at Passover time, as you know, the boy in the family says, why is this night, Father, different from all other nights? It's a teaching tool. I wish in our Protestant churches that we had just half of the teaching tools and half of the visual aids that they used in the Old Testament. Fantastic education. Every year they said the same thing. Why, Father, is this? And they told the whole story of the Exodus of redemption again. There's another time that they ask, as we'll see in the next chapter, and that is at the redemption of the firstborn. And again they say, why do we do this service? And again the answer comes back to explain the historical background of it. Well, in verse 29, it came to pass at midnight the Lord smote all the firstborn of the land of Egypt. So this happened. It actually took place. In verse 31, he called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, rise up, Get on. We're ready. Go. Go serve the Lord, as you've said. Verse 33, all the Egyptians are awake. Nobody's sleeping that night. The Egyptians were urgent enough people. Hey, get out of here. Go on, or we'll be all dead men. Of course, they didn't know that everybody who was going to die had died, but they thought, wow, if they all died tonight, what's tomorrow night going to be like? Every night we're going to have people die. Get out of here. We're all dead if you don't get out of here. You'll notice in verse 34, they took their dough before it was leavened. So there's another aspect here, and that is of haste. So unleavened bread speaks, one, of separation from the continuity with Egypt, and secondly, it speaks of the haste with which they left Egypt. The haste with which they left Egypt. We pick that up again. Verse 39 says virtually the same thing. So they take all of the jewels and so on, and they take on out of there. And verse 38, there's a mixed multitude with them. We move on to chapter 13 very quickly on the firstborn. Now what chapter 13 is about is actually this. God is saying, the night of the Passover, the firstborn of every Egyptian family died. The firstborn of all of the Israel, of Israel's families, could and should also have died. But I provided a way of rescue. If it were not for the blood on the doorpost, they would be dead. So God is saying, in effect, because I redeemed them, because I gave them a way to escape, who do they belong to? They belong to me. They belong to me. They'd be dead if it weren't for me. It was only in my grace that I preserved the firstborn of Israel. Now, lest they forget that and think that they were spared because they were better than anybody else or special people or nice guys or God didn't notice them or whatever, we have the payment of the half shekel every time a firstborn male is born. In other words, when the first boy of a Jewish family is born, they were to have the ceremony of the firstborn, and this payment of this half shekel by the family into the temple or whatever was simply a token. And when they paid that over, they were saying, in effect, we recognize, Lord, that this firstborn is yours. He's yours. He's not ours. In other words, you can have him to use him. He's yours. But they paid the shekel over. I don't want to put it so strongly as saying they're buying him back. But in a sense, they're recognizing their obligation to God for that, to have that, their dependence on God to have that firstborn. It's very interesting that when Jesus, as a baby, was brought up for this ceremony in Jerusalem, and Mary and Joseph brought him up, and they went through the ceremony, they started the ceremony, and it might have finished, we don't know, but there's no record that they ever paid over the money for, in the token for Jesus Christ. And some commentators have suggested that that means that he was never redeemed back, that he actually died as the firstborn. It's a very interesting thought. So that's what chapter 13 is about. Chapter 14, they move on out of there. Well, actually, in the middle of 13, the end of 13, they leave. They take the bones of Joseph, verse 19. They had promised them that. So in verse 19 of chapter 13, they take Joseph's bones. They move on out through the wilderness. You'll follow that on your map. And verse 4 of chapter 14, not only would Pharaoh know that the Lord was the Lord, but he says, I will be honored upon Pharaoh, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. Once again, referring back to 5:2. Now here we get them up to the Red Sea, and I just remind you that they didn't have to go by way of a water barrier. There were other ways to go. They could have gone around them or between them and so on. But you'll notice that it was the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud that got them there. They weren't lost. God had led them to the Red Sea. Tremendous spiritual lesson here. If we had been plotting the course and navigating this thing, we would have looked at a map and said, now, Moses, make sure you don't go down that road, because if you go down that road way, you're going to run smack dab into the Sea of Reeds, the Reed Sea there, and it's going to be very difficult. You can't get 2.5 million people across that, and you're going to be trapped. So be sure you go around it. Okay? Okay. But that's not where God guided them. He guided them right down to the trap, in quotes. In terms of our year verse this year, he took them right up to the wall. With no door. He took him right up there. Furthermore, the place they came to it, there was a mountain on the left and a mountain on the right, and here comes the whole Egyptian army behind them. So what do they do? Say, thank you, Lord, for the opportunity. We're going to see you work. Open a door. What'd they say? Oh, weren't there enough graves in the cemetery of Egypt that we could have died back there? Verse 11. Because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Verse 12, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. How about that? They'd rather make bricks than believe God. I think it's a lot more exciting to believe God at the edge of the Red Sea than it is to just, you know what's going to happen every day. More bricks. Well, more bricks tomorrow.